Hey, welcome to the Parallax Podcast. I'm Liz Brown. Today, we continue our series of episodes covering COVID-19's impact in Philadelphia. I sat down for a Zoom conversation with Brian Murray, CEO and co-founder of Shift Capital. Shift is a social impact urban real estate group headquartered in Kensington that takes a community-driven approach to their investment strategy. They work in close collaboration with the neighborhoods they invest in to rethink traditional real estate financing frameworks, small business models, and community development projects to maximize equitable growth. Brian and I talked in depth about Shift's whole neighborhood approach to development, as well as how impacts of COVID-19 are being felt by Kensington's small business community and what further steps can be taken to help those businesses pull through the economic turmoil of this epidemic. Can we start off with you talking a little bit about Shift Capital for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. So Shift Capital is a B-certified impact real estate group, which means that we are a vertically integrated real estate group like any other real estate group, but we have a really specific mission to align capital with communities. And, you know, our theory of change, so to speak, is to invest in catalytic projects in underserved communities and then to invest all around that real estate in a holistic, at-scale way, in which we feel like we can tip the scales of community wealth building and community development and inclusion in a way that other real estate groups could not. And frankly, a lot of the community development space cannot, because we're bringing, you know, private capital to play and overlapping that with collaborations with nonprofit partners on the ground, collaborations with the community, and you know, really trying to think long-term about how capital moves through communities.
That's really interesting. How did you get to an impact focus?
So for me, this is also a little bit of a personal journey. So I didn't come at it from, hey, I'm a real estate person who's trying to do impact. I came at this as a impact person believing that real estate was a vehicle for impact. And you know, my background is that I'd been an entrepreneur before, where I'd honestly felt like I was chasing money and was not feeling any type of connection to the larger society. I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer, where I had, you know, read USAID and philanthropic reports talking about all this great work on the ground, but not really seeing the connection between that philanthropic work and what happens on the community level. And then I had entered a phase where I really was getting involved in the impact investing space. And when I was getting involved in the impact investing space, I happened to do a small real estate deal in Philadelphia that I got brought into. And it was supposed to be just kind of like a side investment, a side activity. And, you know, that's when kind of these worlds of impact investing and real estate started to merge for me. I realized that underserved neighborhoods, there isn't really a capital problem. It is a problem of what type of capital and the alignment of capital. So most of the capital that runs through lower income communities in Philadelphia is mostly parasitic. And that's a little bit of a large generalization, which is unfair to some smaller groups that are trying to do the right thing. But I often say that, you know, what I learned in those early days was, you know, there's basically two types of slumlords in a lot of Philadelphia and a lot of urban cities in the country. And it's slumlords with a capital S that know exactly what they're doing. And they know exactly how the economics work. And they know exactly how to extract, you know, their capital in the right way. And then there's lowercase s slumlords who probably go in with the right reasons, trying to do the right thing. But the economics of lower income neighborhoods create a disincentive to do the right thing. And I was both as a non-real estate person, as an impact person, and as a human, for me, I was just blown away by what was going on and really realized that there was a huge gap in the impact real estate space as it stood in those days, 10 plus years ago. And what I thought was needed for communities.
So what are some of the things that you didn't see that you thought you could do better?
Well, so when I looked around and said, and I literally asked folks in the impact investing space, and I said, well, what are you doing in real estate? What do you invest in when you invest in real estate? And the answers were pretty, I guess, not surprising, but pretty, you know, pretty consistent, which is, one, there were opportunities to invest in affordable housing and the extension of affordable housing. So affordable housing, traditional tax credits have a certain time period, and then that time period runs out, and there is a real capital need to continue that. So that was one area. The other area was the CDFI world. So community development, financial institutions, and locally, you know, this includes groups like the Reinvestment Fund or LISC. And those were the only things they did in real estate. And my struggle with that was that, you know, and this is no disrespect to the affordable housing world. I think that they do a lot of great work. I think it's actually one of the most powerful programs that the federal government has ever created. But as it relates to the community level, a bright, shiny building gets put into the middle of a neighborhood, and that's it. The incentive structure for affordable housing developers, which is the vehicle that delivers affordable housing, is to earn as much developer fees as possible. So what happens is they come in, they do a building, they say this is going to be a catalyst for change, and then as a company or as a group, they move to another neighborhood and they do the same thing. And these projects get spread out. And, you know, my belief is that there needs to be a concentration of not only capital, but also resources, collaboration, if we are going to really tackle deep poverty. And so I was frustrated that affordable housing was not going deep enough into the community work that I was interested in. And then on the other side, the CDFI world, again, I love my CDFI partners that I work with. I think there's a lot of great work happening, but most of that capital is going to lend money into projects, to small businesses, and also gets spread out. So it gets spread out across Philadelphia. And I think that's a disservice to the reality of the concentration of poverty that we have. And that's where I felt like that's where we wanted to focus.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I actually worked in two housing organizations when I first moved to Philadelphia. And I did a lot of work with going back and forth to HUD and FDIC and affordable housing. And that was kind of my big introduction to the city of Philadelphia as a urban planner. I mean, a lot of money lands in the hands of nonprofit organizations as well to do these housing units. And then some organizations aren't prepared to actually due diligence and track how things are changing in a positive or negative way. Instead, they're just getting away with getting all this money and like just kind of like throwing things in one place or another and not really focus on one central area, because everyone in the same neighborhood is fighting over the same money to continue to do these developments, which really some of them are a really great asset to these communities. But at the same time, I think that if there was more of a focus on where poverty is, then we could actually have a more dedicated response.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would be remiss to not give credit where credit's due as it relates to the CDC network, right? Like, I think you're right, and this is part of why we're coming at it from our angle. But I do think the true heroes of this story, and in a lot of cases, they're under-resourced, and they are, you know, maybe don't have the skill sets because, you know, for XYZ reasons, maybe they have too many things that they have to do. But, you know, the CDCs in the city, you know, there's a lot of strong CDCs that frankly are really critical and to this piece. And for example, in Kensington, you know, our partner, our friend, our group that we lean on the most is a group called Impact Services CDC, that in the storyline of, I mean, let's be honest, what we're doing has some sex appeal to it because we're bringing in outside capital and we're doing something quote unquote innovative and different from people's perspectives. But the reality is that, you know, our work is meaningless without that CDC on the ground, without that partnership, without them doing, you know, really critical work that allows us to be able to bring in other types of capital. And what what we view our role is to help them grow the pie so that ultimately as a coalition, we've got more resources and more angles from which we're tackling things. But I am only saying that to say that I'm very empathetic to the day-to-day challenges that a lot of, you know, CDCs, which are probably the ones that are most on the ground in some of these neighborhoods, and again, sometimes decades of work. And some of that is truly a little bit of the nonprofit cottage industry going on, but a lot of it is just a lack of additional resources that these groups need.
Yeah, I'd completely agree, because the first organization I worked at was a CDC, and they actually owned a significant amount of property, and they did a lot of really great things, which is why I was excited to be there. And over time, I think that they got in some trouble with misusing funding and not doing due diligence properly. But I think that a lot of that was actually because they weren't staffed correctly to catch some of these things as they were happening. I think the CDCs, the people working in the CDCs truly are on the ground in the neighborhoods doing really great things, but definitely don't have the resources they need in all cases to do this without building partnerships with organizations like yours. So I think that I think that's really important that you have an impact focus, that there are people in development who actually care about community. And I think that, I mean, just you having been in the Peace Corps is, you know, that's something I'm not surprised by at all.
It was transformative, you know, just like any of this community development work, but it was nice to be in a different environment where you could really, I don't think there's a greater organization in the country in the world that puts volunteers in people's shoes on the ground. I mean, I would say VistaCorps and to a certain extent, you know, Teach for America and things like that, or AmeriCorps as well, do that a little bit locally, but we need more of that. You know, we need more of that bridge building, and we need to figure out a way to get more people in other people's shoes to understand, you know, what life is like. And, you know, not to go on a quick tangent, but I think one of the greatest benefits of this whole situation, the COVID situation, which I'm sure we'll be talking about, is that, you know, people who otherwise would not have felt what financial pressure feels like are feeling instability for the first time. And can you imagine people living with a lifetime of this feeling? And that's a huge portion of our entire population, but in particular, urban communities of color in Philadelphia. And I think that I'm hopeful that realization, I mean, you know, really starts to put people's feet to the fire as it relates to policy, as it relates to, you know, hey, this does suck, right? And we can do better. So that's my big hope.
I think you're right. I mean, it's an experience that a lot of people that are in a position to make change have not been in.
You know, Philadelphia is a lot like a lot of other cities in the country, but, you know, we have our mainline world that feels that they're Philadelphia, and we have our Philadelphia. And for decades, the wealth of Philadelphia was drive in to Center City and leave. And there are reasons to be optimistic that is changing, in the sense that those barriers are, you know, not as distant. But the reality is, I don't think I could give you a number. It would be absolutely almost several hundred to thousands of people that have come out to our offices, which are in Kensington, either, you know, to visit our offices, or we have an event space called FAME with a small business called Feast Your Eyes that does events. And they, you know, they do bat mitzvahs and they do weddings and all sorts of stuff in this, you know, on the top floor of one of our buildings. And everyone who comes out's like, well, you know, wow, this is Kensington. And, you know, I've never actually been out here. I've never actually even seen the city of Philadelphia from this angle. And, you know, it's just a reminder of how much work we still have to do and will continue to have to do with, you know, I think this is part of the reason for your podcast and part of the reason for probably your work. And, you know, I think it's a paramount for all of us to just keep pounding the pavement on the inequities that are really there to the skeptics who think they're not.
What would you say are some of the biggest issues that that we face here in Philadelphia and Kensington specifically? or the biggest challenges that you have?
Yeah. I mean, I got to put the compartmentalize them a little bit, right? So yeah. I think that there are, let's start kind of, we have, obviously in Kensington, you know, we have the opioid crisis and we have a challenging conversation to have around community as it relates to the opioid community. And there is a community in Kensington of families and people who have been here for decades that feel the city hasn't paid attention to them in decades and feel that the people pay more attention to the opioid users than they've paid attention to them. And on the other side, we really do have an opioid crisis problem. And I think the city kind of wants to contain it within this neighborhood. And so, you know, there's a real kind of dynamic of that on the ground that I think is, you know, as a group that's trying to bring jobs into the community, as a group that's trying to bring entrepreneurs of color and, you know, life back to Kensington Avenue. Well, it's hard to imagine a world where those things coexist well. And, you know, that leads, I think, to a larger Philadelphia discussion about, you know, how are we going to handle as a city what has happened to other cities in the last 20 years? So, you know, DC, you know, being a good example and more recent than others, you know, we know change is happening. We know more people want to stay in the city. People are moving into the city. We are, COVID aside, you know, Lower Kensington has exploded. Lower North Broad has exploded. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves is, you know, what kind of city do we want? What are the tools available to create mixed income communities? So if you start with the premise that, you know, we need to have mixed income communities in order to have healthy communities, which, you know, I think is deep rooted in our philosophy. If you start with that premise, then how do you do that, right? Because what we know right now is that capital and the way neighborhoods change, and I'm not even going to use the word gentrify, I'm just going to say development is happening, it steamrolls communities. And someday, you know, we brought in private capital, and that private capital needs to be returned. And that private capital is looking for a return. And if we sell it to another group that also needs very high returns, then they're going to come in, they're going to say, oh, well, Kensington's more stable now, you know, more desirable from the outside. And therefore, we can continue to raise rents. And we've seen this storyline happen over and over and over. It's like a gerbil wheel that we're on, but we've got to solve how to get off it. And we also have to solve, we've got a great opportunity to think about how to preserve affordability. We, North Philadelphia, most of North Philadelphia, a lot of North Philadelphia is still pretty impoverished and still very challenged. And the opportunity to buy and renovate real estate and create higher quality housing is now. The opportunity to preserve affordability is now. If we don't think proactively, then by the time we start thinking about it in a neighborhood, the opportunity is gone because land values have gone up, rent has gone up, and then it's impossible to go backward. And so we need to figure out how to go proactively in front of this, include communities in the process, preserve our row home housing, the affordability of our row home housing, increase the quality level of our housing. And I believe, you know, I'm not saying that what we're doing is the answer. I think it's part of a larger mosaic of pieces that need to happen. But I do believe that the opportunity for Philadelphia is now.
What I'm curious about is, how do you preserve affordability in a neighborhood that's so rapidly changing for the better? And how do you empower community participation?
Yeah, well, so I'll try to break these into some pieces because it's two separate questions. It's kind of what do we do to get out in front of it, one, and then how do we empower communities? Is that right?
The community participation.
Participation. Okay, so first I can tell you what we're doing in Kensington on the first part of it, and then I'll talk about community participation. So we have a theory that we need to move real estate out of the commoditized marketplace as soon as possible. And what that means is we created in Kensington a neighborhood trust. It is it is fashioned kind of out of the land trust movement. It's fashioned out of some other things, but it's specifically, in our case, it's the Kensington Corridor Trust that will buy, own, and renovate real estate on the avenue. And the governance structure will be controlled by both stakeholders and the community itself. So if we think about this for a second, there's a few things that happen in this model. One is that we are providing the community with more say on what happens on Kensington Avenue, right? They have more of a say of what type of businesses come into it. You know, they have the control of the landlord. A landlord can choose to create a lease with anybody. So there's an opportunity of that type of community participation. Two, we are preserving capital for this community. So if north of Lehigh Avenue, Kensington Avenue becomes a fish town in 10, 15 years, well, now the community, let's say it owns $10 million of real estate. Well, now that real estate might be worth $20 million. So instead of a private investor coming in, investing, renovating, and being able to return money that is probably coming from outside that community, now we've got a vehicle where that appreciation value, not to mention the cash flow that comes from that real estate, gets to stay in the neighborhood. And the neighborhood gets to decide, okay, where do we want to put that money? Do we want to put it towards affordable housing? Do we want to put it towards cleaning? Do we want to put it towards supporting our entrepreneurs on the avenue? We choose. And the flip side of it is because it was done so early in the neighborhood development, then the basis is pretty low. So the opportunity to have cheaper rents maybe, or to take more risks with certain entrepreneurs is greater. So I believe that as a country, we need to develop more concessionary capital tools. So the money that we're bringing into this is either going to come in as grants that get to use, or they come in as PRIs or program related investments. And basically those program related investments only need, let's say, 2 or 4% returns on its money. So that's very different than a private capital that needs, let's say, 10, 15% returns. So we think that there is more and more interest nationally to think about how do we use capital differently other than just, hey, philanthropic over here or pure capitalism over here. And part of our role is really trying to carve down that niche and apply that into a community, you know, a community development model. So the second part of your question is community participation. So I would say that there is a continuum of ways this can happen. And I applaud any part of that continuum because as a real estate developer, I understand how hard it is to take. I mean, on one hand, it's not that hard to take a little extra time to do some forward thinking things with the community. But, you know, yes, inviting them in to give you feedback on what you should have there is one part of the participation, but I think it's just not enough. So, you know, we look at it as kind of multi-tiered. On one hand, you have jobs that are going to getting generated from our work or our tenants' work. So on one hand, that's construction, right? So how are we working with minority local subs on the ground? How are we building them up, their capacity up? How are we making sure that they're able to compete on, you know, larger projects, not only in Kensington or Broughton Erie or Sharswood, but citywide? That's one piece of it. Two, how are we making sure that the tenants that come into this ecosystem are bringing the same values that we value? So when they go to hire people, Do we have the avenue set up so that they can make local hires wherever possible? So, you know, jobs is a big piece of this. The other piece of this is actual community wealth building. So how are we working with our local partners like an Impact Services, and how are we working with them to think about homeowners that are in the neighborhood? How do we work with them to make sure that homeowners have all the educated components of this? How do they know when to sell if they want to sell, or not to sell if they want to keep, and how to make sure they can hold on to their home and build that wealth? Related to that, you know, we, in conjunction with Impact Services and with an appreciative nod to Ken Weinstein over in Germantown, you know, we launched the Kensington Jumpstart Program, which is a real estate accelerator that is geared toward people in the community and people that have been left out of the real estate process. So it's workshops, it's mentors, it's funding coming through some philanthropic partners that help others do what we're doing, which is buying properties, renovating them, and starting to build wealth, whereas they would have been left out of this in the past. So my point I want to drive home is that I think community participation is on a continuum. There are multiple ways to think about community participation. And I think that there are shallow and deep ways to go on community participation. And I think part of our mission is to share our learnings, what we've done well, what we've done wrong, with other developers who also want to do impact, and sharing with them how we think that they can accomplish that.
I think it's interesting that you're looking at it from a deeper level, because a lot of people do just have a community meeting and then call it a day and say, all right, we got the input we needed, and don't really put their hearts into their work. So yeah. I commend you for that. I think that's really awesome to hear. And I think that's why working within a specific community is so important. You know, we need to keep doing this type of stuff and make neighborhoods stronger and see the more positive side to a changing neighborhood rather than always see the negative in it. And, you know, I also wanted to ask you, in what other ways has COVID-19 impacted your work at Shift Capital?
Yeah, so like a lot of businesses, we're scrambling like anybody else. You know, construction got shut down in the city. That was a big part of our ability to keep our lights on, was some, you know, larger construction projects that we have going on. So we certainly on that side of our work, you know, did what a lot of groups did. We have taken advantage of the paycheck payroll program. And that's one of the only reasons why we've been able to keep everyone together. We, you know, all of our whole salary team have taken cuts. We kept all of our hourly workers full time and, you know, full pay. And then I think what's probably more interesting than just kind of the shift story is the ecosystem. So, you know, we cater to a lot of small businesses, and, you know, whether it's through our Making Studios work or whether it's some of our businesses on the Avenue, and what is happening is absolutely tragic, and it's way worse than it's been reported. You know, some of that's starting to come to light now with the who's who of who's getting paycheck payroll protection program and who wasn't, who has access to banks, who doesn't. But we've had, I would probably have four or five businesses literally just called us up and they said, we're done. You know, we can't continue. And, you know, real businesses, real people, real entrepreneurs taking real risk. And, you know, like a lot of entrepreneurs, in particular women entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs of color, not having the same access to capital. So a lot of it is bootstrapping. And when you're bootstrapping and something like this comes along, you know, you got a month's worth of cash? I mean, if that, if you're lucky. And so watching that in real time and trying to do what we can to, you know, defer rent, to get them to resources, and knowing that even doing all that still doesn't save the day, or I mean, that it's rough. And we're watching it firsthand happen, and it stinks, because I think it just sets back neighborhoods like Kensington that I think on one hand had the opioid crisis, on the other hand, you know, had some real economic development momentum. it sets us back a couple of years. And, you know, in the vacuum comes a lot of additional challenges. So we've got nonprofit partners who are struggling. We've got small businesses that are struggling. You know, we were going to do a hospitality project over at Broad and Erie. I don't know if that'll ever happen now. And, you know, that was a huge, you know, we got Marriott on board. It's really going to be a big deal for this intersection. We were working on the community benefits agreement with the community and talking about that, what that looks like and means. And it's tough out here. It's tough.
If you try to look at it as I've heard people say, you know, every setback is a setup for your comeback. I think that's the best way to look at it. And I do, you know, I work with underrepresented founders of startups and small businesses. And I think that it's been devastating. I mean, it was already difficult for people to get just basic funding to rent or buy or just support your team and have the supplies you need to get by. It was already such a challenge. And now you're just seeing businesses fall apart left and right. And even the people who give advice on a day-to-day basis and have been doing this for 20 plus years are having a lot of trouble telling people what the next best steps are. I think the next best step is to take it one day at a time and just stay positive and try to do what you can to keep going. But I think that, again, being proactive rather than reactive, which you had talked about earlier in this discussion, is really key. I think that if people try to keep their heads up and do what they can to stay proactive, things will eventually come back around and hopefully for the better. If nothing, these types of things make people come back stronger. If it weren't for all of my losses and failures throughout the years, I would never have had a successful software company. I would not have a lot of opportunities in front of me that I have today if it weren't for all of my failures. So if nothing less, this is a lesson learned to everybody who went out of business during this time or is in a major pivot. I think everyone's there. Every industry is in some kind of a pivotal moment right now. So I'm trying to stay positive as best I can and, you know, keep my head up so that the people who look out here and see me can see something smiling back at them, because it's really hard to go through this. Even for me to be doing this podcast from home is very challenging. All we can do is hope for the best. And I'm glad that there are other people out here just doing good in the world. It's nice to be able to share that message at this time.
Well, I appreciate the time and I appreciate that. Yeah, that closing on such positivity. I think that is absolutely something I'll take away from this chat as well. So thank you. And I'm happy to chat, happy to get the positivity and happy to, you know, try to stay positive in this whole situation.
Thanks so much for listening, and a very special thanks to Brian for taking the time to do the interview. If you'd like to learn more about Shift Capital or even help out with their work, check out their website, shiftcapital.us. Have any thoughts on this conversation? Be sure to leave us a review in Apple Podcast. You can also connect with us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or send an email to info@parallaxcollab.com.